I vetoed both the CR and the debt ceiling bill, and the next day at noon, large portions of the federal government shut down. Almost 800,000 workers were sent home, disrupting the lives of millions of Americans who needed their applications for Social Security, veterans benefits, and business loans processed, their workplaces inspected for safety, their national parks opened for visits, and much more. After the vetoes, Bob Rubin took the unusual step of borrowing $61 billion from retirement funds to pay our debt and avert default for a while longer. Not surprisingly, the Republicans tried to blame me for the shutdown. I was afraid they'd get away with it, given their success at blaming me for the partisan divide in the 94 election. Then I got a break, when at a breakfast with reporters on the 15th, Gingrich implied that he had made the CR even harsher because I'd snubbed him during the flight back from Rabin's funeral by not talking to him about the budget and asking him to leave the plane by the back ramp instead of the front one with me. Gingrich said, "It's petty, but I think it's human. Nobody has talked to you and they asked you to get off the plane by the back ramp? You just wonder, where is their sense of manners?" Perhaps I should have discussed the budget on the way home, but I couldn't bring myself to think about anything but the purpose of the sad trip and the future of the peace process. I did visit with the speaker and the congressional delegation, as a photograph of Newt, Bob Dole, and me talking on the plane showed. As for getting off the back of the plane, my staff thought they were being courteous, because that was the exit closest to the cars that were picking up Gingrich and the others. It was 4:30 in the morning. There were no cameras around. The White House released the photo of our conversation, and the press lampooned Gingrich's complaints. On November 19th, I made a move toward the Republicans, saying that, in principle, I would work for a 7-year balanced budget agreement, but would not commit to the GOP tax and spending cuts. The economy had continued to grow, with the deficit dropping more than expected. Panetta, Office of Management and Budget Director Alice Rivlin, and our economic team believed we could now get to balance in 7 years without the harsh cuts the Republicans were pushing. I signed 2 more appropriations bills for the legislative branch and the Treasury Department, the Postal Service, and general government operations. With 6 of the 13 bills now signed, about 200,000 of the 800,000 federal employees were back at work. In early December, after almost 2 weeks devoted largely to the unfolding peace processes in Bosnia and Northern Ireland, I vetoed another Republican budget. They'd made a few changes in it and tried to make it harder to veto by including their welfare reform bill in it. But it still featured big cuts in Medicare and Medicaid, virtually eliminated the direct student loan program, opened the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling, raised taxes on the working poor, and was full of favors for special interests, including a relaxation of the rules that kept pension funds from being depleted for non-pension purposes, less than a year after the Congress had stabilized America's pension system. The next day, I submitted my own 7-year balanced budget plan. The Republicans panned it because it didn't accept all their estimates for revenues and expenses. We were $300 billion apart over 7 years, not an insurmountable difference in an annual budget of $1.6 trillion. I was confident we would eventually reach an agreement, though it might take another government shutdown to get us there. On the 14th, I flew to Paris for the official signing of the agreement ending the Bosnian War. I met with the presidents of Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia, and went to a lunch with them hosted by Jacques Chirac at the Elysee Palace. Slobodan Milosevic was sitting across from me, and we talked for a good while. He was intelligent, articulate, and cordial, but he had the coldest look in his eyes that I had ever seen. He was also paranoid, telling me he was sure Rabin's assassination was a result of betrayal by someone in the security service. Then he said that everyone knew that's what had happened to President Kennedy, too, but that we Americans had been successful in covering it up. After spending time with him, I was no longer surprised by his support of the murderous outrages of Bosnia, and I had the feeling that I would be at odds with him again before long. When I came home to the budget war, the Republicans shut down the government again, and it sure didn't feel as if Christmas was on the way, though seeing Chelsea dance in the Nutcracker brightened my mood considerably. This time the shutdown was somewhat less severe, because about 500,000 federal employees deemed essential were allowed to work without pay until the government reopened. But benefits to veterans and poor kids still weren't being paid. It wasn't much of a Christmas present to the American people. By Christmas, I had felt for some time that if left to our own devices, Senator Dole and I could have resolved the budget impasse fairly easily. But Dole had to be careful. He was running for president, and Senator Phil Graham was running against him with Gingrich-like rhetoric, in Republican primaries in which the electorate was well to the right of the country as a whole. In December, the complete Whitewater story came out when the Resolution Trust Corporation inquiry was released. The report was written by Jay Stevens, who was a Republican former U.S. attorney whom I had replaced. It said, as had the preliminary report in June, that there were no grounds for a civil suit against us in Whitewater, much less any criminal action. This was what the New York Times and the Washington Post had wanted to know when they called for an independent counsel. I eagerly awaited their coverage. Immediately after the RTC report was released, the Post mentioned it in passing in the 11th paragraph of a front-page story about an unrelated subpoena battle with Starr, and the New York Times didn't run a word. The Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, and Washington Times ran an Associated Press story of about 400 words on the inside pages of their newspapers. The TV networks didn't cover it either, though ABC's Ted Koppel mentioned it on Nightline, then dismissed its importance because there were so many new questions. Whitewater wasn't about Whitewater anymore. It was about whatever Ken Starr could dig up on anybody in Arkansas or my administration. To be fair, a few journalists took note. Washington Post writer Howard Kurtz wrote an article pointing out the way the RTC report had been buried. And Lars Erik Nelson, a columnist for the New York Daily News who had been a correspondent in the Soviet Union, wrote, quote, "The secret verdict is in. There was nothing for the Clintons to hide." In a bizarre reversal of those Stalin-era trials in which innocent people were convicted in secret, the president and the first lady have been publicly charged and secretly found innocent. I was genuinely confused by the mainstream press coverage of Whitewater. It seemed inconsistent with the more careful and balanced approach the press had taken on other issues, at least since the Republicans had won the Congress in 1994. One day after one of our budget meetings in October, I asked Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming to stay a moment to talk. Simpson was a conservative Republican, but we had a pretty good relationship because of the friendship we had in common with his governor, Mike Sullivan. I asked Alan if he thought Hillary and I had done anything wrong in Whitewater. "Of course not," he said. "That's not what this is about. This is about making the public think you did something wrong. Anyone who looked at the evidence would see that you didn't." Simpson laughed at how willing the, quote, elitist press was to swallow anything negative about small rural states like his or mine. He made an interesting observation. "You know, before you were elected, we Republicans believed the press was liberal. Now we have a more sophisticated view. They are liberal in a way. Most of them voted for you. But they think more like your right-wing critics do, and that's much more important." When I asked him to explain, he said, "Democrats like you and Sullivan get into government to help people. The right-wing extremists don't think government can do much to improve on human nature. But they do like power. So does the press. And since you're president, they both get power the same way, by hurting you." I appreciated Simpson's candor, and I thought about what he said for months. For a long time, whenever I was angry about the Whitewater press coverage, I would tell people about Simpson's analysis. When I finally just accepted his insight as accurate, it was liberating and cleared my head for the fight. By January 2nd, we were back to the budget negotiations. Bob Dole wanted to make a deal to reopen the government, and after a couple of days, so did Newt Gingrich. In one of our budget meetings, the Speaker admitted that in the beginning, he had thought he could keep me from vetoing the GOP budget by threatening to shut the government down. In front of Dole, Army, Daschle, Gephardt, Panetta, and Al Gore, he said frankly, "We made a mistake. We thought you would cave." Finally, on the 6th, with a severe blizzard covering Washington, the impasse was broken, as Congress sent me two more continuing resolutions that put all the federal employees back to work, though they still didn't restore all government services. I signed the CRs and sent Congress my plan for a balanced budget in 7 years. As we headed into the State of the Union speech on the 23rd, we seemed to be making some progress on a budget agreement. So I used the address to reach out to the Republicans, rallied the Democrats, and explained to the American people my position on both the budget debate and the larger question that the budget battle presented. What was the proper role of government in the global information age? The basic theme of the speech was, quote, "The era of big government is over, but we cannot go back to the time when our citizens were left to fend for themselves." The most memorable moment of the evening came near the end of the speech, when, as usual, I introduced the people sitting in the First Lady's box with Hillary. The first person I mentioned was Richard Dean, a 49-year-old Vietnam veteran who had worked for the Social Security Administration for 22 years. When I told Congress that he had been in the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City when it was bombed, risked his life to re-enter the ruins four times, and saved the lives of three women, Dean got a huge standing ovation from the entire Congress, with the Republicans leading the cheers. Then came the zinger. As the applause died down, I said, "But Richard Dean's story doesn't end there. This last November, he was forced out of his office when the government shut down. And the second time the government shut down, he continued helping Social Security recipients, but he was working without pay. On behalf of Richard Dean, I challenge all of you in this chamber, let's never, ever shut the federal government down again."